All right, I will talk about artificial skin ice. This is meant to be informal. Please feel free to interrupt at any point. Don't wait until the end, or you might forget the question. Here are some examples of artificial spin ice systems that have been built over the last 6 years or so by different groups. Most of them involve magnetic systems, as the ones shown over here. These are permalloy islands with a typical size of maybe 1 micron or so. This is a suggestion to implement artificial ice using some colloidal crystals. And I'll show you some more systems that are even bigger than this. Here's an outline. I'll introduce or continue introducing spin ice and pyrochloroxides. There have already been some mention of that. I'll explain how dipolar interactions give rise to magnetic charges of excitations. And then I'll switch to the description of artificial spin ice in arrays of nanomagnets, discuss square ice and Kagami ice, and then talk about the dynamics in these systems, which is sometimes thermally activated and sometimes it's externally driven. And we'll try to understand the origin of the ice rules in these artificial systems, which turns out to be different from what happens in natural spin ice on the pyrocolloids. So here's natural spin ice and natural ice. The ice rules were invented by Bernal and Fowler to describe the states of protons in water ice. So the big circles show oxygens, and the little black ones show protons that reside between them. They tend to be between two oxygens and closer to one of them, so that you get an H2O molecule. So each oxygen has four neighbors oxygens, and it has two protons nearby and two protons farther away. These belong to other water molecules, so to speak. Steve Bromwell and his colleagues in 1997 discovered an interesting pyrochlor ferromagnet, dysprosium titanate and holmium titanate, in which something like that happens. You have spins that live in the quarters of the pyrochlor network of corner-sharing tetrahedra, and the spin-orbit coupling and the electric fields in the lattice conspire to point the large magnetic moments of those spins, they can be as big as 10 Bohr magnetons, either toward the center of a tetrahedron or outward. So these are easing spins with the particular direction that varies from site to site like this. And they discovered that for ferromagnetic interactions between nearest neighbors, you end up with a very frustrated system which has ground states such as shown here, with two spins pointing into a tetrahedron and two spins pointing out. It's very frustrating because you can select very many configurations like that, so it's hard to choose a particular ground state. There are so many of them. You can put together tetrahedra of spins, and there are a great many ways in which you can place the tetrahedra together. This is the Hamiltonian of the system, which only includes the exchange interactions for now. And if the exchange interactions were antiferromagnetic and the spin axes were fixed like that, then you might realize that the angles between the axes of different spins is about 109 degrees. So if the interactions were antiferromagnetic, then you could point all of the spins out of a tetrahedron, or all of the spins into a tetrahedron, and you would have a ground state because they would tend to be anti-parallel rather than parallel. But with ferromagnetic interactions, you can't make them all parallel with this orientation of the axes, and hence you have so many ground states. You can learn a lot more about natural spin ice than I can do here in 5 or 10 minutes. There's a new book that John already mentioned, Introduction to Frustrated Magnetism, that came out in 2011. You can read it online if you have subscription through your institution, or you can buy it. And many chapters are actually available on the archive. So the relevant chapter written by Michel Gingras is available as this preprint. So these are ground states of a system that contains two tetrahedra with four spins on one, four spins on the other. And here you have two spins pointing in and two out. This is known as one of the Bernal-Fowler rules translated for spin ice from the water ice language. If you have many tetrahedra, then you end up with this large number of possible configurations that scales exponentially with the number of spins in the system. And so if you take the logarithm of that, you get an entropy that's proportional to the volume of the system. That was first calculated by Linus Pauling for ice. And it was measured for spin ice beautifully in a 1999 experiment mentioned by John Chalker. So these are ground states with two in and two out. This here is shown as an excited state. You have three spins pointing out on this tetrahedron and three spins pointing in on that tetrahedron. And what I changed here is I just flipped the central magnetic moment. So both of these tetrahedra are now in excited states. The situation on the pyrochlore spin ice actually is a little bit more complicated than I've shown before with just this exchange term. There are also dipolar interactions between spins. So if you take magnetic moments and use this dipolar interaction, which is pretty complicated, long-ranged, and it's very hard to understand what exactly the dipolar interaction wants the spins to do. If, say, you have one spin here that can point vertically and you have another spin there, then they would like to be parallel, as the field generated by this spin points upward. But if you have these spins oriented like so, or located like this, then if this spin points up, it creates a magnetic field that comes up and then goes down, and so this spin would like to be anti-parallel to it. So the relative orientation of spins in the ground state would depend on where they're located relative to each other, and so it's not exactly clear what kind of a ground state one would like to have. So when you add these dipolar interactions, even though you have perhaps an exact ground state for the exchange Hamiltonian, with two spins in and two spins out, these ground states, which are quite plentiful, they should probably have different dipolar energies. And if you had an opportunity to go through all of the ground states and see which one has the lowest dipolar energy, then perhaps there would be some kind of an ordered state selected by the dipolar interactions. Michel Gingras worked on that about a decade ago, but the surprising result was that pretty much all of the spin ice states with two spins in and two spins out had almost the same dipolar energy, which was a puzzle for a while. People kept thinking about that, and they came up with a surprising answer for that puzzle, how it turns out to be that all of the ground states of spin ice have essentially the same dipolar energy. It was explained perhaps most beautifully by Claudio Castelnuovo, Rodrick Mester, and Shivaji Sondi in a Nature paper in 2008. The idea was to slightly deform the physical Hamiltonian or the physical system. Instead of thinking about point-like spins that live at the corners of the tetrahedra, they said, well, let's take these spins. They're tiny dipoles. They're really tiny dipoles, but let's stretch these dipoles in such a way that they point from the center of one tetrahedron to the center of the other tetrahedron, like so. So instead of point dipoles, we have really long dipoles with a positive magnetic charge at one end and a negative magnetic charge at the other end. And then these four dipoles come together at the center of every tetrahedron. And you can think of the magnetic dipolar energy as of the Coulomb interaction energy of these point-like charges at the ends of these dipoles. And if you have two north poles and two south poles coming at the center of every tetrahedron, then the net magnetic charge there cancels, and you should have no magnetic field generated by these objects, and so you will have a very low magnetic energy. And so this dumbbell model of spin ice, as they called it, explains nicely why all of the spin ice states have roughly the same dipolar energy, and they remain nearly degenerate. If you keep thinking along these lines, then the nature of excitations is pretty interesting. So you flip one of these dumbbells, and instead of contributing a red one here and a blue one there, it contributes an extra blue one here and an extra red one there. So you have a net magnetic charge that's negative here and that's positive there. So your excitations become magnetically charged objects or magnetic monopoles. Let me say a few words about the concept of magnetic charges and magnetic monopoles, because it rattles the nerves of my high energy physics colleagues, who immediately start asking questions as, does this lead to the quantization of electric charge and all the Berry-phase effects? The answer is no, it doesn't, because these are not sources of magnetic induction B. These are sources of magnetic field H, and that's a big difference. So the magnetic monopoles that our particle physics colleagues would like to capture at some point would be sources of B. So these would be the divergences of B, which we know is zero in the absence of those monopoles. And our monopoles are sources of H, the magnetic field. So you can write the dipolar energy in this form that you all know and love from your E&M courses, which is pretty hard to understand. This energy, just like the Coulomb energy of a direction of electric dipoles, can be rewritten as the integral of the magnetostatic energy, mu naught H squared over 2. For electric system, it would be epsilon naught E squared over 2. And this energy you can rewrite in terms of the interaction of sources of H, like so, just like you would for the electric field as well. As the Coulomb interaction of electric charges, here you rewrite it as the interaction of magnetic charges defined to be sources of H. Now, since magnetic induction has no sources, and the magnetic induction is the sum of H and M, it follows that the divergence of H is the same as the divergence of M up to a sign. So sources of H turn out to be sinks of M, and vice versa. So if you have magnetization lines that terminate at some surface, that is a sink of M, and so it's a source of H. It's a positive magnetic charge. And if you have a line that starts at some surface, magnetization line that starts at the surface, you have a negative magnetic charge. And so you can then use this expression to think about the energetics of the system. This expression shows that it's a positive definite expression. It cannot be lower than zero. So if you can get rid of magnetic field entirely, the dipolar energy would be zero. One way to do this is to make sure that there are no magnetic charges anywhere. So if rho is zero, then this energy becomes zero, and so you will have no dipolar energy. So getting rid of magnetic charges is a sure way to lower the dipolar energy of the system, and that's why you need two poles coming into every tetrahedra and two poles, or two dipoles coming in and two dipoles coming out. Any questions so far? Okay. So what's cool about spin ice is the nature of its elementary excitations. Here I'm showing a one-dimensional toy model of spin ice, which you can reproduce very easily at home. You have a chain of dipole magnets with the north and the south pole lined up like this. If you have the north and south poles touching at every junction, then the magnetic charge in the middle is zero. You only have magnetic charges at the left and on the right. This is a negative magnetic charge, and this is the positive magnetic charge. Magnetization points this way everywhere, so the magnetization line starts here, hence a negative magnetic charge. It ends there. It's a positive magnetic charge. So this is a ground state of the system. And if you play with neodymium magnets, you know that this is the ground state. If you take one of the magnets, say this one, and you flip it like so, then two north poles come together and two south poles come together, and you have a positive magnetic charge here and you have a negative magnetic charge, both of double strength there. And then if you flip one of the neighboring magnets, say this one, you move the positive charge away from the negative charge, and so now these two objects can move around on their own, entirely independent of each other, almost. So that's the idea. The interesting thing here is that your fundamental degrees of freedom were magnetic dipoles, right? You started with dipole magnets, but excitations turned out to be monopoles. A monopole is a fraction of a dipole, so this is known as fractionalization in the language of theorists. And fractionalization is a fairly familiar theme in one-dimensional physics. You have lots of other examples in one dimension, but in higher dimensions it's not so common, so that's why it was a surprise that in three-dimensional pyroclor ice you get excitations of this sort. So here's a two-dimensional toy model that explains what happens in spin ice that's three-dimensional. You have a bunch of magnets forming a square lattice in this case, and if you examine this picture carefully, you will see that at every junction you have two north poles and two south poles coming together, so there's zero magnetic charge at every junction. So that's one of the ground states, and there are plenty of ground states you can cook up here. And if you flip a few of these, so here I flipped this chain of magnets, you end up with two excitations. Here you have a negative magnetic charge, and here you have a positive magnetic charge that are well separated, and they can travel independently of each other, or almost independently of each other. The nice thing about these excitations is that you can drive them with a magnetic field. If you apply an external magnetic field, that magnetic monopole will feel a force acting on it. A dipole experiences a torque in a magnetic field, but these objects experience a force, so they can be pushed around. If you apply a magnetic field in the horizontal direction, pointing, say, to the right, then this monopole would feel like going this way, and this monopole will feel like going that way, so you can pull them apart with the magnetic field. So this is another example of fractionalization. This time it happens in two dimensions, and in three dimensions it's a similar picture, although it's not easy to draw it. But if you go to, say, Castelnuovo et al.'s paper, you'll see how this works in three dimensions. So, mesoscopic spin ice, or artificial spin ice, the idea was first realized by Peter Schiffer's group at Penn State. They decided to study spin ice in a different system. Instead of rare earth ions, they built an array of magnetic islands. These are permalloy islands, soft magnet, which is magnetized, so the horizontal ones would be magnetized along the positive X or negative X direction, and it's just like a bar magnet, really. It likes to point, its magnetization points along its longest axis. The typical size of these islands is about a micron or a fraction thereof, and they have this elongated shape. Since then, there have been quite a number of papers published in the glorious journals, such as Nature and Science, with other realizations of these arrays. This one shows a Kagome spin ice, in which the spins sort of form the Kagome lattice, and I will describe them in some detail. These systems can be thought of as the literal dumbbell version of spin ice, because here you have magnetic dipoles that extend almost all the way from here to here. And so they do meet at the center of the junction, and the magnetic moments can kind of cancel completely, or magnetic poles can cancel completely. But there are crucial differences between these artificial systems and their natural counterparts, in that a spin is not really a single spin. In fact, if you count the number of atoms within these islands, here are their typical dimensions, They contain lots and lots of magnetic moments. So they don't behave like a single magnetic moment. There will be crucial differences that I will explain. So as you have seen, I've been calling the system mesoscopic spin ice rather than artificial spin ice, because now there is even bigger and better artificial spin ice than these systems that was invented by a couple of our former students, Paolo Miata and Andres Concha, who were postdocs at Harvard until recently in Laha Devan's group. And here it shows a macroscopic version of spin ice. You have literally bar magnets this big, arranged in a Kagami lattice, and you can flip them around, and they demonstrate some very nice dynamics. But I won't be talking about these. My talk is about mesoscopic spin ice, a system I've been studying for about 5 years now. So here's the original square ice that was put together by Peter Schiffer's group. This shows the morphology of the sample. And this is an MFM image showing black and white north and south poles. So this is how they detect the direction of magnetization. The poles show up in the MFM images. There can be different types of configurations at every junction. The ones that one expects to see in a spin ice system are these, type 1 and 2, where you have two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out. They're split into two different subtypes, 1 and 2, because these two are not related by symmetries. Say, you can go from type 1A to type 1B by flipping all spins, time reversal symmetry, or you can go between this configuration and that configuration by reflecting the spins in the horizontal plane, right? So all of these are related by symmetry, and these two are also related by symmetry. So they must have the same energy. But type 1 and type 2, even though they both satisfy the spin ice rules, they don't necessarily have the same energy, and in fact, type 1 should have a lower energy. Can you tell why it should have a lower energy? Why type 1 should have a lower energy than type 2? It's easier if you think in terms of magnetic poles. In type 1, two north poles are pretty far apart. They're like this. And in type 2, two north poles are a little closer. These are the neighboring vertices, and here these are farther apart. They're along the diagonal of a little square that you can make out of these poles. So type 1 should be a lower energy, and if your magnet could achieve one of its ground states, it should be a ground state with only type 1 vertices. In fact, it would be an ordered state in this system. But it turned out that in the original 2006 experiments, no matter how hard the experimentalists tried, they always had lots of junctions that violated the spin ice rule. You can look at these three colored junctions. This one has two in and two out. This one has two in and two out, but this one has three in and one out. So 30% or more violated the spin ice rule. Here's a little table that illustrates similarities and differences between the mesoscopic and the microscopic spin ices. So both of them can be made to obey ice rules. There are systems that perfectly obey spin ice rules in the mesoscopic world. But the origin of these ice rules turn out to be different. For the pyrochlore spin ice, it's the energy considerations that tend to enforce the two-in, two-out rule. And as we will see in mesoscopic spin ice, there are other considerations that lead to the enforcement of ice rules. They have different dimensionalities. Energy is conserved in the microscopic spin ice, but it's dissipated very easily in mesoscopic spin ice because, as I mentioned, every single spin is a bunch of smaller spins that can dump their energy to the lattice, and the energy tends to be wasted in the system very efficiently. So the dynamics is very different. There's intrinsic thermodynamics in microscopic spin ice, unless you go to a very low temperature when the system pulls out of equilibrium. But in mesoscopic spin ice, there tend to be no thermal fluctuations, and so you have to somehow agitate the system, shake it, in order to get some dynamics, as I'll describe later. So thermal equilibrium is possible in microscopic spin ice, but it's kind of hard to achieve in mesoscopic spin ice. So I put some asterisks here, which mean that there are some exceptions to these rules, and sometimes natural spin ice can fall out of equilibrium, and sometimes you can achieve thermal equilibrium with artificial spin ice, as it turns out. But for the most part, this works. So why are there no thermal fluctuations in the mesoscopic spin ice? Well, you can make a simple estimate of how much energy it would cost to flip a mesoscopic spin island. Here are some relevant variables. You have magnetization length measured in the SI units. If you work in micromagnetism, you quickly discover that everyone uses the SI units, the dreaded SI units. So it's 10 to the 6th amps per meter. The element width is 100 nanometers. The element thickness is about 10 nanometers. And if you want to cook up something with the dimension of energy, from these numbers, mu naught m squared is energy density, so you multiply it by a volume, which turns out to be thickness squared times the volume. You get an energy of 10 to minus 17th of a joule, which translates to a million kelvins. So in order for the system to go from pointing this way to pointing that way, it has to overcome an energy barrier that's this big. That's a tall order, because the relaxation rate depends on the barrier in this activated way. And if you work at a temperature of 300 kelvins, this factor that just kills any relaxation in any dynamics at all. And so you can't expect any thermal fluctuation in the system. So spins don't feel like fluctuating at all. Sometimes you can overcome that. Done in a recent experiment in Christopher Marrow's group, in which they reduced the thickness of the system. You recall the energy barrier is proportional to the thickness squared. So if your thickness goes down by a factor of 10, then the activation barrier goes down by a factor of 100. And so what they did was they gradually grew their samples, and as the samples grew, they were already magnetic, and the macro spins actually fluctuated. So when the thickness was on the order of 1 nanometer or so, thermal fluctuations could happen in the system. And interestingly enough, if you examine your system on a short scale, you see that pretty much it has it falls into one of the ground states with two spins pointing in and two spins pointing out, and it's one of the ordered states. So here in this graph, you see the lots of ground state area with domain walls separating them. So this system is fairly nicely ordered, it turns out. You can discern some monopole, anti-monopole excitations out of the ground state like this. You can see some domain walls between the two ground states in the system. You can also reduce magnetization. If you go close to the Curie-Weiss temperature, then you end up going through a phase transition from a ferromagnet to a paramagnet. So if your system has a sufficiently low Curie-Weiss temperature like this one does, about 230 kelvins, if you work closely to the phase transition, your magnetization is sufficiently reduced. And so since the barrier is proportional to m squared, you go down and by a factor of 10 in magnetization, the barrier gets lowered substantially. These researchers from Uppsala used pretty thin elements, so that also helped. And so they claim that in the temperature range between 200 kelvins and 230 kelvins, they can detect no magnetization in the system, even if they apply a magnetic field. This is below the Curie-Weiss temperature of the continuous thin film. So in principle, in this range, magnetic moments on the individual islands must have formed. But if they thermally fluctuate, then even the application of a small field will not dissuade them from fluctuating. So this perhaps is a nice thermal spin ice state in the system. Another way to overcome this reluctance of spins to fluctuate is to shake them. So you just take the system and you violently move it in some way. So here you can do it by applying a magnetic field. Peter Schiffer's group devised a clever shaking protocol. They applied an oscillating magnetic field in one direction, and they rotated the sample so that the spins were subjected to a rotating and fluctuating magnetic field. So perhaps this could create some sort of a thermal ensemble, but even if there was a thermal ensemble in this case, which is not clear, you still have lots of defects violating the ice rule. This problem was remedied by another group. John Cummings of the University of Maryland came up with a spin ice system that was driven externally by a rotating and oscillating magnetic field, exactly in this way, and it turns out that in this system the ice rules were obeyed perfectly. Here's a sample. If you look at the sample on a finer scale, this is what you see. You have a honeycomb lattice. It's called Kagami ice because if you connect the centers of these islands, they form the Kagami lattice, and the magnetization points from the middle of one tetrahedron to the middle of another tetrahedron. So here's the scale of the system, and you can investigate how the system works. In fact, if you look closely, you will see that these bars have a black stripe on one side and a white stripe on the other side. This is Lorentz microscopy, TEM, tunneling electron microscopy in the Lorentz mode. So electrons go in and come out, and if there's magnetization in the sample, they're shifted sideways. So the black stripe indicates in which direction the electrons are pushed by magnetization inside the sample. So from that, you can detect the direction of magnetization in every magnetic element. And what you discover here is the ice rules modified suitably for this lattice, two spins in and one spin out, or vice versa, they are obeyed 100% of the time. No matter what you do to the sample, it's always in a spin-ice state. You can apply a strong magnetic field, magnetize everyone. So if you apply a vertical magnetic field, two spins will point this way, one spin will point that way, so it obeys the rule. You can also have disordered state like this one if you subject it to this interesting protocol. So what do you expect of spin-ice on Kagami? Well, it's an interesting system. Here, the magnetic charges are not compensated because you can't have equal numbers of spins pointing in and out. And so there are always magnetic charges, and you might find an interesting state in which the magnetic charges order and the spins remain disordered, like in this picture. So here, on every up triangle, you have a positive charge, and on every down triangle, you have a negative charge. But if you examine the spin picture, you don't see much order. So you can have fluctuating spins and ordered magnetic charges. So, since the thermal fluctuations are suppressed in the system unless you make some very special arrangements for that, we were interested in how the dynamics in the system works when you subject it to an external magnetic field and in how the ice rules come about, because the energy doesn't seem to play any role here. It turned out that it's not so much energy, it's energy gradients or forces that are important in this case. And in the next few slides, I'll basically outline our understanding of this system. Any questions so far? Okay. So here's a square ice. This is a Kagami or honeycomb ice. And the main actors in this game turn out to be magnetic charges at the vertices, something that already have introduced, and also domain walls that propagate inside the magnetic elements. These are also magnetically charged. If you look at the magnetic element on the really microscopic scale, you discover that it has regions with uniform magnetization pointing right and left, but you also can have domain walls between them. So these domain walls carry a non-zero magnetic charge, as you can ascertain by putting a box around this domain wall and counting how much magnetic flux goes into it. So here we have positive magnetic flux, or flux of magnetization flowing this way and this way, and you can calculate that the charge of this domain wall would be 2 in some natural magnetic units. One coming from here and one coming from here, and that makes it 2. If you examine a wire, and if its magnetization points, say, this way, you can apply a magnetic field in the opposite direction, and if the field is sufficiently strong, the magnetization in it will reverse. But usually it will not reverse everywhere at the same time. It will start somewhere. You will create a new domain with magnetization pointing the other way, and it will be separated by 2 domain walls from the original domain. And so these domain walls will propagate through the system. They'll be pushed apart by the magnetic field, and they will accomplish the magnetization reversal. So these are pretty important objects. And here's how this magnetization reversal happens in a system like that. It's a micromagnetic simulation by Jacques Miltat's group at the University of Paris in Orsay. The process can be actually pretty complicated. So here you can see that the dynamics of this domain wall is pretty interesting. You have initially some uniform motion, and then something got emitted from the edge of the system. And you can spend long hours simulating these and just being mesmerized by these nice pictures. Or you can come up with a theory of that, which we did a few years ago. So the bottom line is like this. You start, say, with a junction where you have 2 spins pointing out and 1 spin pointing in, and that gives you a charge of -1. You apply a magnetic field in this direction, and this field would like to reverse the magnetization in this element. So what it does, if you do a simulation, you can see that it tries to pull something out of the junction. What it pulls out of the junction is a domain wall that carries magnetic charge of -2, and this domain wall is now being pushed to the right by the magnetic field, and eventually it accomplishes that goal, and then you're left with a positive magnetic charge because now there are 2 magnetization fluxes coming in and only 1 coming out. So you started with magnetic charge -1, emitted a domain wall with charge -2, you're left with a charge +1. We can estimate the critical field for this process by using some very simple considerations. So here is a depiction of that state. You apply magnetization in the positive x direction, and what you do is you take out a doubly charged magnetic domain wall out of the junction, and if the charge -1 that's left behind and the charge +2 are sufficiently far apart, the interaction between them is Coulombic. It decays as 1 over r squared, so if the distance between them is A, then this is the force between these 2 charges. It's an attractive force because they're oppositely charged, and you use the external magnetic field to pull the domain wall away from this charged vertex. Now, this, if you plot this, the dependence of the force on the distance, it goes down. But so this gives an impression that when the distance between them becomes small, this force blows up, which is, of course, not true. When the 2 magnetic charges sufficiently overlap, actually the force is very small. So the force starts out small, 0, when they're not separated, it goes up, and then it comes down. So there's a maximum somewhere. That maximum force is what the external field has to overcome. And you can guess that the typical distance at which the force peaks is the same as the size of these magnetic charges themselves. And so A turns out to be on the order of the width of your element, and so using these considerations and plugging W, the width for A, you can get an estimate for the magnetic field required to reverse magnetization in your element, and you can come up with an estimate of a few tens of millitesla, which is the right order of magnitude. Now, this already tells you why there are no charge 3 vertices in the system, because if you want to create a charge 3 vertex, you have to start, say, with minus 1 and move domain wall with charge plus 2 out of it, leaving behind the charge minus 3. Now, but this requires a much bigger force applied to this charge 2 system, charge 2 domain wall, because it's now attracted by a much bigger negative charge. And so it requires a field that's 3 times as big. So if you increase the field gradually, you only create charges with plus 1 or minus 1, but you never leave behind charges plus 3 or minus 3. So that's, in a nutshell, why the spin-ice rule is enforced in this system. As you can see, the reason is quite different from the previous cases. You can see a sequence of events that leads to the magnetization reversal. You start with this, apply a field like that, emit a domain wall that propagates to the other end of the system, and it gets absorbed by this vertex, and so you switch from plus 1 to minus 1, and from minus 1 to plus 1. So that's how the dynamics happens in this system. I have a lot more to say, but I will do so on Monday when I give another talk, so you should feel free to come to that one and get the full story of this. Experimentalists can actually measure the critical fields and the effects of disorder that are pretty important here, and so on. But I hope that I've conveyed the basics of artificial spin ice, and I'll just go to if I can, to my conclusions. Artificial spin ice combines nanomagnets or micromagnetics, as the field used to be known, with frustrated magnetism. The major players here are mesoscopic spins made out of hundreds of thousands or millions of spins, and magnetic charges that reside on the vertices of the lattices. Magnetization dynamics is inherently dissipative and is mediated by the motion of magnetically charged domain walls. And you can actually track the motion of these magnetic monopoles through the system in real time. Sometimes the reversal proceeds in a nice manner. Each island flips on its own when its critical field is reached, so to speak. Sometimes it involves avalanches. So this system resembles granular matter to a large extent, more than pyrophore spin ices. Magnetic Coulomb forces and quench disorder, which I didn't have time to discuss, play major roles here. Thank you. Is the microscopic spin ice a spin liquid? It was covered in Leon Balance's Nature Review article, so perhaps it qualifies as a spin liquid. It's a spin liquid in the sense that it's disordered. If you examine a typical ground state, you don't have an order parameter that's non-zero. But as John Chucker pointed out, these spin-spin correlations actually don't decay exponentially. They decay as a power law. This is typical of models with constraints, such as the six-vertex model, for instance, and it's related to a six-vertex model. Is spin-ice, pyrochlore spin-ice critical? Well, if in the absence of monopoles, you can say it's critical because spin correlations are 1 over r cubed. So it's a little bit like the triangular lattice antiferromagnet, easing antiferromagnet at zero temperature. It has similar properties. So magnetic Coulomb force plays a major role in artificial ice. Is it known whether the magnetic Coulomb force is important in pyrochlore spin ice? That's actually a good question. I would you should probably so John may comment on that.
Ha 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 ha.